Timothy, I just think you do a phenomenal job. I mean, you really are really listening to what I'm saying, and you're really finding the connections and kind of weaving everything together to really have a more powerful message for your audience. And I'll be honest, you actually helped me learn about myself through this as well. So no, it was a very powerful conversation with you. Thank you.
Hey everybody, it's Monday, and our focus today is innovation in the social sector. So we're going to dive into our social justice system. And as the time for today's mentoring conversation drew closer, my mind led me back to a fourth grade girl I'll call Marilyn. I was her special education teacher when she lived and I worked at the Bush Wilder Foundation Treatment Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. I stayed in touch with Marilyn, who was awarded to the state of Minnesota. When I found her caseworker, she referred to Marilyn not by her name, but as a case number. I sat quietly horrified. The caseworker's load was so large, she didn't know the names of those under her care. It wasn't her fault. At that point, I decided it important to help Marilyn find her parents. Eventually, I found Marilyn's parents living in two different parts of the Twin Cities. I arranged for meetings with both parents separately. It was good for understanding her history. It was so important to her. It was also important for her parents. Both parents, however, were incapable of taking care of Marilyn, and so it was a very tenuous situation. But growing up in a state foster care system leads to intermittent parenting and the constant feeling of rejection, fear, and abandonment. Marilyn spent some of her teen years in and out of the juvenile detention center. I began the process to adopt Marilyn before her juvenile detention center stints, but I couldn't do it as a single person with a small business I had just launched. I could barely keep afloat myself. Another tragedy for Marilyn. When 14, Marilyn told me she waited a year to have her first of three children with three different dads. It wasn't exactly what I was thinking of when I told her to wait with becoming a parent, but life happens. Three fathers also in and out of the criminal justice system. Tragic stories, almost impossible lives. How can someone whose parents ward a child to the state ever recover? They don't. Deeply scarred and wounded, parents raise deeply scarred and wounded children. One generation isn't going to be cured from generations of trauma. I'm passionate about correcting injustices. Injustices get corrected by leaders who start social movements and lead through for-profit and nonprofit organizations. I feel today's guest, Emily Baxter, will further open your eyes like it did mine to the concept about criminality. Emily Baxter is the founder and executive director of We Are All Criminals. She has served as the director of advocacy and public policy at the Council on Crime and Justice in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and as an assistant public defender at the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation, where she represented indigent members of the Leech Lake and White Earth bands of Ojibwe charged with crimes in state court. Emily is a former fellow at the University of Minnesota Law School's Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice. She began developing We Are All Criminals, a book that she wrote, through a Bush Fellowship in 2012. Oh, I'm sorry, that's weareallcriminals.org. She started a nonprofit organization through a Bush Fellowship in 2012. Is that right, Emily?
That's right.
Oh, good. Okay. WeAreAllCriminals.org is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that seeks to inspire empathy and ignite social change through personal stories of crime, privilege, justice and injustice, and disrupting the barriers that separate us. We envision a more just and equitable world where each of us is able to transcend our past and reach our full potential. Your book by the same title is about who gets arrested and who gets convicted and why. The We Are All Criminals book opens your eyes to different areas of privilege and helps people see that it could simply be the kind of day an officer has or straight up racism that could ruin a person's life. We are all criminals, and the people telling their stories in her book either didn't get caught participating in the criminal activity they described, or they just got a slap on the wrist. Everyone should read this book. There's no way someone could read this and not have learned to have even the smallest bit of empathy for those who are accused or caught and incarcerated. 1 in 4 people has a criminal record. 4 in 4 have criminal history. So we're going to talk about that. So welcome to the podcast, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me, Nancy.
Yeah. So we're on a Skype call because you've recently moved to another state.
It's true. And just as the weather got warm there in Minnesota.
Yeah. As luck would have it. Oh, good. So as I do with every guest, I asked people how they're feeling so that we can have this human connection with each other. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling okay. Today has been a catch-up day in many ways. I've spent the last few weeks on the road, and so I've been trying to get my inbox under control, wrangle the emails, and figure out what this week ahead looks like.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. And what's the temperature in where you're at?
Oh, it's quite lovely. It was, I believe, a steady 72 today.
Okay, very nice. Wow, not as warm as Minnesota. That's a shift.
And that is something you can't say often.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And so, where are you traveling right now?
I just returned from a 3-week trip in Minnesota and South Dakota.
Okay. And you returned.
I was there in your backyard.
Right. My husband took a yoga class. Yeah, with you. So you're in North Carolina, South Carolina, somewhere out southeast?
That's right. I'm in North Carolina right now.
Okay. And I'd like to just explore some of the things that led up to you publishing your book and starting your nonprofit.
Sure.
Okay. So, did you grow up in Minnesota?
Close. I grew up in South Dakota.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about your family.
Sure. I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We like to think of ourselves as a suburb of Minneapolis.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Not very many people outside of Sioux Falls do know that, but I can tell you that there's a well-greased pipeline from Sioux Falls to Minneapolis when it comes to high school. I think people get their diplomas, fill up their car with gas, and head northeast. I grew up in Sioux Falls. I have a couple of sisters and one younger brother, and my parents and my brother still live in Sioux Falls.
Okay, excellent. And what were some of the favorite things that you used to do when you were younger that seems to be something that you do now?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I used to write, and I think I do quite a fair amount of that now. I like gathering people together for a common purpose. My mother ran a daycare, and so I was often, I think, creating little clubs and movements within the kids that were there at the house. We always seemed to have some cause that we were lobbying for, be it an extra time in the backyard or another helping of whatever she was serving up for lunch. I think that I would create little advocacy pods even then.
Oh. It started early. Yeah.
And I read a lot. My mom is, well, she's retired now, but after the kids were all in school, she went to work at the library, the public library. And I think it was her love for reading, her love for books, and kind of that quest for knowledge and unending curiosity that she instilled in each of us. So I grew up reading a lot, and I think I still do that now quite happily.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, reading is such an eye-opener. And speaking of which, your book was a really big eye-opener for me. I mean, I keep thinking about 1 in 4 people has a criminal record, and 4 in 4 have a criminal history. Your book is so beautifully outlined with, do you want to go ahead and you talk about how you outlined your book?
And, oh,
and
sure.
maybe we could start
with you. Thank you for that. That's very sweet.
Okay. I was also thinking of maybe if you could tell us a little bit about what led up to you writing the book, or if you want to read your 4 in 4 introduction. How
oh,
would you?
Sure.
Yeah.
I can do that.
Okay.
So this is the introduction to the book and the chapters titled 4 in 4. Several years ago, I was living in Minneapolis, working at an overstretched and underfunded legal advocacy organization. Should I just fill in some details here?
Yeah.
You know, some of this is because I can tell your listeners what the org was. All right. So
yeah, that would be great. Fill in whatever you would like to fill in.
Sure.
I'm fine with going with the flow. Because I think, I think that will be good for our listeners.
Okay. So this is an introduction to the book, and the chapter is titled 4 in 4.
How about if you say, or I'll say this. So this is your reason for why you wrote the book.
Right. Yeah.
It's what it led up to.
There's some background. Yep.
Okay.
As to where I was when, I should say it wasn't the kind of advent of the book, but rather the project itself. So several years ago, I was living in Minneapolis and working at an overstretched and underfunded legal advocacy organization known as the Council on Crime and Justice. Sadly, it has since shut down. At the time, I'd recently left my job as an assistant public defender, and I was hungry to change the system that had been so relentlessly stacked against my clients. My daily work concerned legislative and policy change, while at night and on the weekends, my colleagues and I met with the people who couldn't wait for the trickle-down of a statutory shift. These men, women, and youth, all economically disadvantaged, overwhelmingly Black, Brown, and Indigenous, had lost their jobs, homes, opportunities for education, and licensure because of a past mistake. With so much else taken away, I wanted them to be able to hold on to hope. Twice a month, we held criminal records clinics, the first in an open community room on the north side, the second in the drab, windowless basement of a downtown government center. In these spaces, Minnesotans would wait for hours to speak with an attorney, someone who could help decipher their criminal record and determine their eligibility for expungement. That's the court-ordered sealing of a criminal record. It was a lengthy process. Criminal records are notoriously difficult to read and frequently rife with error, and a mix of statutory limitations and subjective measures determine the likelihood of expungements. When it comes to a court's decision to seal your records, it matters why you committed the crime. Now, of course, many of the participants were haunted by records of wrongful arrests, dismissals, and acquittals. It matters what you've done since the offense, as evidenced by rehabilitation, education, employment, and civic engagement. And it matters how the record has affected you. Essentially, how it has prevented you from doing the very things that might prove your redemption. I'm sure the sun had long since set when in walked our last participant. Anthony was tall, thin, black, and clearly distraught. He walked hesitantly toward the front of the room. As he sat across the table from me, he pulled from his back pocket the copy of his criminal record. He printed it from a computer terminal two flights up. The dread and defeat on his face were heavy. I opened it, expecting to see a recent aggravated robbery, multiple felony assaults, or substantial fraud. Maybe he was eyeball deep in probation or restitution. Whatever it was, it must have been so egregious to warrant his worry. It wasn't. Instead, it was a minor theft. I let out a small laugh of relief. Even if the court doesn't expunge the matter, I said, it's not like your life is over. And with that, Anthony started to cry. Earlier that day, he had considered taking his own life. You see, what was just a theft to me, to Anthony, it was a lost job. It was missed housing payments. It was skipped meals. It was the loss of respect from his friends and family, the loss of hope, the loss of a sense of self. Now, around the same time, I'd been driving around the state, reaching out to employers and landlords, legislators and licensing boards, asking them to make second chances possible for individuals with criminal records. I knew that the overwhelming majority of decision makers used background checks as shortcuts for assessing character and worth, and I knew just how difficult it was to move on and move up from a criminal record. Time and again, I would hear, you can't trust a con, or once a criminal, always a criminal. Those words came back to me as I sat across from Anthony, who was folding and opening and staring at the paper, refolding, reopening, and staring again at the paper, as if expecting what was written inside to suddenly change or disappear. I wondered, how many times had I taken something that wasn't mine? Sure, I'd considered my own criminality before, but not like this. I hadn't really thought about what life would be like in the shadow of that record, under the suffocating stigma of having been caught. What would life be like if I didn't have the luxury to forget? I thought about my friends, my family, my colleagues. I thought about my college classmates, my high school coworkers, my neighbors. Time and again, I had either witnessed them violate the law or had joined in the offense myself. From petty to serious, recent to ancient, each among us had broken the law. I thought about where we were now, lawyers, doctors, architects, accountants, academics, engineers, and entrepreneurs, mothers, fathers, leaders, and creators, men and women defined by our professional and personal status, not by our criminal history. So for the past few years, I've been asking people like me, the 75% of people in the U.S. with criminal histories but no record, what have you had the luxury to forget? Many of the people whose stories I've collected are, like I am, white and middle class. So I ask a follow-up question. What roles did race and class play in your ability to get away with it? Since 2012, I've been traveling across the country, sharing and collecting more stories, deconstructing the us versus them dichotomy that plagues both our private thoughts and public discourse about crime and criminality. I ask students and scholars, police and prosecutors, employers and policymakers to challenge and change the divisive and destructive narrative that dominates our concept of the criminal justice system. Those stories became the We Are All Criminals, or as I like to call it, WAC project, and in 2014, that project became an organization. Since that time, WAC has been used as a catalyst for conversations about race and class, privilege, punishment, and second chances around the world. The project has assisted in Ban the Box efforts, education equity demands, and calls for a compassionate criminal justice system. I've heard from cops who've told me that their approach to policing has changed since realizing not just a shared criminality, but a common humanity. I've heard from policymakers who are taking it upon themselves to say that if voters are tired, are calling for tired, tough-on-crime approaches, it's their turn to stand up and educate the electorate. I've heard from professors who say that WAC is a tool that finally illustrates privilege for their students and communicates their duty to do something about it. And I've heard from employers that second chances have given them first-rate employees, people they would have rejected had they not considered their own histories. Here's more good news. WAC is just one part of a much larger movement. Many political and faith leaders of all stripes are joining business and advocacy leaders in saying that mass criminalization and mass incarceration do not work, and that they make us less safe as they eviscerate our nation's economy and communities. In addition to these remarkable efforts, I've continued to ask those of us lucky enough to live without the shadow of a criminal record to answer the same simple question. What have you had the luxury to forget? After all, this isn't about supporting a single petition or policy. It's about shifting the way we see others by altering the way we view ourselves. This is a call for reason, equity, and mercy across the board. Together, we own the problem and the solution. I do this so that someday soon, when Anthony opens the folded page that's used to define his character, I hope that he finds not thief, but father, caregiver, nurse, cook, speaker of multiple languages, survivor of genocide, volunteer coach, and avid reader. The mark of a man no longer tethered to his past, but wholly able to live in the present and dream of his future. Anthony and millions of others deserve to be defined not through their worst moments, but by their true worths. They deserve, as much as any of us do, the opportunity to be forgiven and the luxury to forget.
So as you move through the book, you've outlined a person's position, and then they have also, like, bank teller is their title, and then underneath it says theft, the crime that they got away with, or a graduate student, burglary, or a federal officer, aiding and abetting sale of controlled substances. It's a beautifully designed book, and you outlined it in with that first story of describing the four and four and sharing this particular story. And then you lay out the landscape of why we're all criminals and the perpetual punishment and the stories behind that, the war on drugs, widening the net, the war wages on, what mass incarceration looks like, foreclosed futures, policing in America, draining America, the ripple effect, and then rethinking and reinvesting. You've got some fantastic ideas. And I wanted to kind of weave in how you, so the writing that you started with and the gathering of people early in your childhood carried you throughout your life. Is that right? And brought you to this point in your career?
Yes, I think that my childhood had an influence on my adulthood, absolutely. And I also think that I'm cherry picking memories of of my youth that seem relevant to today and relevant to the conversation now. But I think it's fair to say that as a child, I was always deeply interested in other people and liked bringing people together for a common purpose. And I think it's fair to say that that's what I'm still trying to do now, decades later.
Yeah. Well, and it's work that you're meant to do. I can see it because it's part of your purpose, do you think, for being here?
I think so. I mean, I can tell you this, that this work energizes me and feels more deeply authentic than anything I had done before, at least within the legal realm.
Sure.
And so if that kind of ease and happiness that comes with the work is a mark of one's calling, if you will, then I think that this could certainly be it.
Yeah, and we don't always know our path. I mean, this is that nonlinear pathway. You also have taken beautiful pictures that say 1,000 words. And where did you develop your gift for photography?
Oh, this is just from the project itself. I had a middle school teacher who has become a very close family friend, Barb Iverson. And in college, Barb lent me her camera. I think it was an old Canon, a film Canon, that I took on a trip with me. And after that, I purchased a point-and-shoot some years later. But while I enjoyed taking photographs, I certainly didn't see it as a part of my identity or something that I was even halfway good at. But through this project, I knew that I needed to find a way to show that I was talking to real people as kind of picture proof that I wasn't just making up these stories, that these were individuals who were sharing with me crimes that they had gotten away with. And I also think that it's important to, as you say, a picture is worth 1,000 words, right? And the vast majority of the people who are photographed, and for your listeners, I do photograph the people who share their stories, but I take the photos in such a way that conceals their identity. So there are not faces that are shown, but rather hands or feet or perhaps the contents of one's fridge or junk drawer, something that attempts to relay an individuality and a personality and, even a little humanity, but of course without identity. And so it's an interesting challenge to be able to, or it's an interesting challenge to take photos of people in ways that relays that personality without showing their face. Since we show, and without showing a lot of the other trappings that might relay an identity to a viewer.
And right, so like you've got one picture that I really enjoy. It's a woman who's holding up a sign, sticky fingers, over her face. Oh. And she's a prosecutor by trade, and her crime that she got away with is shoplifting. So, I mean, that's really a clever way that you get your point across. So it sounds to me like the photography part was something that was part of developing in a way to express yourself and get your message across. That the audience would really take a moment to pause. I mean, there's many pauses throughout your book.
I think that's fair. I also think that it's important to understand the context that the visualization of the criminal has played within our understanding of crime and criminality.
In our consciousness.
When you Google image, say criminal, chances are you don't see upper middle class white individuals who are going about their daily lives, be it taking their kids to soccer or leading a board meeting. They're not the individuals that you would see in a Google image search of what defines a criminal. Chances are that that search would look a lot more like what you see if you go down to a county courthouse and attend an arraignment hearing. So deeply, deeply, deeply poor people who are primarily people of color and Indigenous people being just devoured by our criminal justice system. And so this project, through the use of photography, tries to challenge that concept of what a criminal looks like by showing the hands of somebody with a really nice diamond ring or, you know, right. A nice watch or someone's cat or a pug, you know, who doesn't love a pug? The attempt to kind of flesh out more what, yeah, I guess I'm not describing that very well. Sorry, Nancy.
Oh, I think you're doing great. I think what you're trying to do is, and what came across really well in your book was creating pictures that show another element of this person's life. Or what they've written has, you know, shown them as more of an individual person, which is, again, the dichotomy between those who have a criminal record where they just get the mugshot. They don't get any other aspect of their lives are reflected outside of the mugshot.
Exactly.
And that, that signifies... that signifies, you know, the beginning of a whole different chapter in their life. It's really, okay.
Yeah. So some of the photos that you'll see in the book have children in them or, you know, babies, like I said, pets, cars, homes. As you say, you get to see a little bit more of that individual's context, a little bit more of that person's narrative, even beyond what's captured in the two or three paragraphs. You see that person as a fully formed human being. You see them as your doctor, as your professor, as your neighbor, as yourself. You see, you're better able to relate to the person who's being quite honest and open and saying that they have committed this crime. And because of that, because of that admission, they're challenging that concept of criminality.
Yeah, and you also talk about like the color of, you have comments, you know, so outside of featuring different people, you also have sections where you talk about like the color of guilt, the presumption of innocence. So like you write, according to a study published in the Crime and Delinquency Journal, one out of every two young African-American males has been arrested by the time they reach the age of 23 for any offense other than a minor traffic violation. That's in comparison to a general population average of 1 in 3. Said the Today's author, many males, especially Black males, are navigating the transition from youth to adulthood with the baggage and difficulties from contact with the criminal justice system. So who ends up in the juvenile justice system is one of the most glaring examples of racial injustice in our nation. So those types of things are an eye-opener in your book, and I would like to spend our next conversation, if you're up for it, to talk a little bit more about what's going on in our country and also how this is connected with the work that you're doing.
Sure. Sounds good.
Okay. Well, thanks for being here, and we worked out our little Skype glitches.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the work that you're doing so much. It's part of what's happening on a larger scale nationally. And I think together, many people can do great work to change the social injustices in our world. And I think we can do it through innovation in the social sector, which is what you're doing. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for being here. Well, through Skype.
Thank you, Nancy.
Okay. And thanks everybody for tuning in. And I hope we've given you some thoughts to ponder And I'll have a link in the bottom so that you can go to Emily's website and really purchase her book. It's a beautiful book, as well as very insightful and astonishing in many different ways. And thanks, Mike Cabrera, sound engineer, photographer, videographer, mon frère, my brother. We'll see everybody next week.